This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Inflation is back, baby!
All right, might be an exaggeration, a little bit.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 2nd of May today, Wednesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We got today from the Federal Reserve probably the closest thing to central banker euphoria we are ever going to hear. The Fed wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates this afternoon. Actually, I should say that's kind of a misnomer because ain't nobody out there thought they were actually going to raise rates. But they did, I'm sure, have a robust conversation about the state of this economy, which gets us back to the aforementioned euphoria, couched as it had to be in bland, if not downright boring, Fed speak. Here's the quote. On a 12-month basis, the Fed said in its statement after the meeting, both overall inflation and inflation for items other than food and energy have moved close to 2%, end of quote. What you got to know there for it to make sense is that 2% inflation is what the Fed has tried to be getting inflation to for years now. Also doing just fine, oh, by the by, was the labor market, the Fed said, all of which is to say, in another turn of phrase, Janet Yellen, well, she was right. About the labor market, by the way, we get the April unemployment report on Friday morning. There is one more thing, though, to say about inflation and where it and this economy go from here. And it kind of turns on what kind of inflation we're getting. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
The Federal Reserve is doing a tricky dance. You might call it a two-step. The Fed is trying to keep inflation at 2%, excluding volatile food and energy prices. But
it's kind of a squishy target.
Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at Stifel. She says the Fed would tolerate inflation up to, say, 2.5% for the next 6 to 12 months. She says that's because inflation from strong economic growth can be a good thing.
Domestic inflation caused by an accelerating economy absolutely could be initially viewed as a very positive indicator.
But inflation that's not caused by a growing economy, that's not good, says Robin Anderson, senior economist at Principal Global Investors. She says bad inflation is
inflation that goes up without seeing increases in people's income and wages.
That would be inflation caused by things like trade wars. If prices tick up, not because of a humming economy, but because of tariffs or quotas that make products scarce and more expensive. Tate Lacey is with the Cato Institute.
If we got into a trade war and that caused massive price distortions, I would classify that as something that would definitely be a bad thing. And we'd have to watch to see how the central bank responded.
That bad inflation could cause the Fed to get a bit more aggressive with bigger, faster interest rate hikes. Good or bad, Tate says, the Fed won't let inflation get too far away from its 2% target. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so about those tariffs, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the gang, that'd be Larry Kudlow from the National Economic Council, Robert Lighthizer, the trade rep, and Peter Navarro, the director of the National Trade Council, are on the ground in Beijing today, resting up before their big tariff meetings tomorrow. And one of the things to keep in mind as these talks get going is that most American companies doing business in China are making some money, so they might want different things out of the talks than the negotiators do. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has more on that from Shanghai.
Around our office here, there's at least one McDonald's, a Nike shop, and 8 Starbucks, including a 30,000-square-foot roastery, which, after 4 months of opening, still has loyal fans lining up to get in sometimes. American firms have been very successful in China, even though U.S. companies operate under restrictive rules, says Kent Kettle with the consultancy group Control Risks. Like, you have to form joint ventures in certain sectors, and sometimes
the Western companies, foreign companies want to invest in China, they agree to transfer some technology.
However, he says,
in exchange for that, they were given free land. They were given a whole ton of benefits. it's easy to forget that in the early days of, and actually till probably just 8 or 9 years ago.
Kettle says forced technology transfer has been going on for the past 3 decades he's been in China. And for a long time, it didn't matter, says Sean Ryan with the China Market Research Group, because China was so poor that U.S. companies were easily number one here.
But the reality now is that Chinese companies are as good, if not better, than many American firms. And China is now the largest or second largest consumer market in the world. So winning China is now, in many ways, a do-or-die strategy for American companies.
So here's what the U.S.-China Business Council's Jacob Parker suggests the American delegation should push for: protection of intellectual property.
China can certainly encourage a tougher deterrent, particularly criminal penalties for commercial-scale infringement.
And also
eliminate any kind of distinction between foreign companies, domestic Chinese companies, and state-owned enterprises.
But he says it's unlikely that these issues will be resolved during the meeting, because, he says, the American delegation hasn't outlined clear goals. What U.S. businesses he represents don't want is for the Trump administration to impose more tariffs just for the sake of tariffs. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
We're going to do a little bit more now from the project we've been working on the past week or so. Stories from some of the companies that have applied for exemptions from President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs. We've talked to about a dozen companies. In all, there have been more than 3,500 applications. But even with our small sample size, there are some trends, like it's a whole lot of paperwork.
What's life been like here? Well, obviously, we've spent a lot of time and we've gotten more educated and more involved in this process than I ever thought I would be.
Charles Smith is the vice president of operations at Tokosin USA. That's a tire cord producer out of Conway, Arkansas. He says their entire business is basically on the line if they can't get an exemption for the imported steel that they need because nobody's making what they need here.
If you can't produce tire cord in the United States, then you don't have tires.
Here's a great twist in this story, though. When the president announced the tariffs a month something ago, they got together with the two other big makers of tire cord in this country, and they applied for an exemption as a coalition. That is, working with instead of against their biggest competitors.
I've worked here for almost 25 years, and I didn't even know my competitors' names until we started this process.
Smith's pretty confident he's going to get it. It's a tire safety issue, he figures. Tokosin VP of Engineering Jim McNeil says he's got his fingers crossed.
We take prayer requests. We accept them.
Prayers and public comments as well. Their application and hundreds of others are up at regulations.gov for 30 days for those public comments. You can check them out if you like. On Wall Street today, a pretty typical trader reaction to the Fed saying nice things about the economy. If the Fed is happy with things, interest rates are going to keep going up, which always takes a little bit of life out of the equities party. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. An interesting thing happened in K-12 education yesterday, and it happened right here in Los Angeles. The Board of Education of the Los Angeles Unified School District picked a guy named Austin Buettner as the new superintendent of schools. Buettner's been a philanthropist and an investment banker, also the deputy mayor of this city, and for just a quick bit, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, too. Notice that the word educator or education administrator was nowhere in that description of the person chosen to lead the second largest school district in this country with more than 500,000 students. Huge bureaucracy doesn't begin to describe it, and that's before you get to the district's financial problems. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Buettner's financial management experience, both on Wall Street and at L.A.'s City Hall, could help as the massive school district stares down a looming financial crisis caused by soaring employee pension and health care costs. By 2030, it's estimated the district will spend nearly half of its budget on retirees' health care and pensions. And UCLA education professor Pedro Noguera says that's not LAUSD's only problem.
On top of that, it's been losing students, losing about 100,000 students to charter schools, but also about another 100,000 due to demographic changes. And when you lose students, you lose revenue.
Buettner has close ties to Eli Broad, another philanthropist who spent some of his fortune supporting charter schools in L.A. He'll also have to navigate a complex political landscape. He's facing labor issues. Teachers in Los Angeles have been negotiating a new contract for more than a year, threatening to strike over school funding issues. Gloria Martinez is with United Teachers Los Angeles.
We think that hiring Buettner sends a terrible message, not only to our community and our students, but really across the nation. Qualification and experience don't matter. What matters here are the connections.
LAUSD is also struggling academically. Test scores have flatlined, and still 1 in 5 students doesn't graduate on time. John Vallant at the Brookings Institution says when other urban school districts have tried unconventional leaders, the results have been mixed. Buettner faces a challenging assignment.
He's going to have to understand that the heart and soul of the school system is what goes on in classrooms, and it's not what goes on with the budget.
When he takes the job on May 14th, Buettner becomes the 7th L.A. school's chief in the past decade. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Amazon announced this week it's going to expand its offices in Boston and Vancouver. 5,000 new jobs to those cities, which is great, but small beans, really. Compared to the big prize that Amazon has been dangling, its second headquarters, 50,000 jobs, billions of dollars of new investment as well. Shandy Race is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been covering the winners and the not winners in the Amazon sweepstakes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do me a favor and remind us what Amazon was looking for, is looking for in its HQ2, as the saying goes.
So Amazon's looking to build a mega second headquarters somewhere in the U.S. in a big city with a population of 1 million people with good public transportation. And they're going to invest something like $5 billion into this project. So this is a huge win for any city that gets it.
Which is why 238 cities applied. We got the news in January that there were 20 lucky finalists. Y'all called the losers, I guess, or this is the unsuccessful applicants, probably.
Right.
What did they say that Amazon had told them? Some of them, anyway.
So Amazon held post-mortem phone calls with a number of these cities. They actually called almost every single city.
Wow.
But the head of the search project, this woman named Holly Sullivan, senior executive, she would list for them the reasons why they didn't make it. The primary reason tended to be because they didn't have a big enough pipeline of tech talent.
Hmm.
But other things like regional transportation, public transportation, those were also very important in a lot of these places. And those two things are sort of connected because, you know, a lot of these places are cities that just aren't necessarily big enough on their own. But if they had a really good regional transportation network, then they could have people come in from other parts of the area.
And that is, I think it was Detroit, right? That's the Detroit example. And they had a debriefing and Detroit had tried to get a regional transport system in years past. It failed. And now maybe the city's hoping that it can get it done this time because of these results.
Exactly. This is something that they can say to their constituents. Listen, you know, you didn't vote for this last time. You should vote for it now if you want us to really, you know, go all the way in revitalizing Detroit.
Okay, but here's the however comma question, and it goes like this. Should cities really be taking advice from ginormous companies who basically just want to profit from them?
You know, there's been a lot of criticism over this whole HQ2 process. I think the biggest criticism has been that it's created this sort of beauty pageant among cities where mayors are just going a bit bonkers, sort of throwing every kind of incentive they can imagine. I mean, literally billions of dollars in tax incentives are being thrown at Amazon. But these cities that didn't win are now looking at what Amazon didn't like about them and saying, oh, well, we've got to fix ourselves because this is what's wrong with us.
Do you think then that these cities are kind of betting on the come that there are going to be more ginormous companies coming to them with a bidding process saying, hey, listen, show us what you got?
Yeah. And I think one potential misplaced bet that they're making is that they are all trying to cater to tech companies. And tech is obviously a very important industry, but not every region is going to be Silicon Valley. And it seems like a lot of cities don't really want to accept that.
All right. So let me put you on the spot. I've got my guesses as to where HQ2 is going. What city do you like?
My guess, and this is like totally uneducated, I think D.C. because
same.
Jeff Bezos, this is the CEO of Amazon, bought the Washington Post. He's got this, you know, big house there. But it's hard to know, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, what kind of incentives are in play. So many different things could be at stake. But yeah, that'd be my guess.
Yeah, me too. Shandy Race, she writes for The Wall Street Journal. We got her in Chicago. Shandy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
He may be an American, but he's got British roots.
Yeah, roots going back 600 years. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 0.7% today after the Fed decision, 174 points, 23,924. The NASDAQ erased 0.4%, about 29 points there, 7,100 even. S&P 500 tossed off 0.7%, 19 points, ended things at 26.35. The Fed, as I said, lived up to expectations and did nothing on interest rates. But investors did something. They sold. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 0.7%. Morgan Stanley forfeited about 0.2% today. Apple continued its post-earnings climb with a 4% gain. The company's suppliers also cashed in. Semiconductor company Qorvo tuned up more than 3%. Cirrus Logic rose nearly 2% today. Bond prices, well, they held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You hear the phrase online universities. Mostly it's for-profit schools like the University of Phoenix and DeVry that come to mind, right? In point of fact, though, one of the biggest online universities in this country isn't for-profit, but rather non. Liberty University is a Christian school in Lynchburg, Virginia, best known for its founder, Jerry Falwell, now his son, Jerry Falwell Jr., who has, since he took over 10 years ago, turned the school, which does have a physical campus, into a very efficient online moneymaker. Alec McGillis from ProPublica wrote about Liberty University in an investigative piece with the New York Times. First question I had for him when we chatted was how a once small and not very well-run school came to be the enterprise that it is.
The university is now extraordinarily successful. It nets more than $200 million a year, which makes it one of the most successful nonprofits in the country, one of the most profitable nonprofits, you could say. Yeah. And it does this really through its online degree program. It's just remarkably lucrative enterprise.
You spoke with Jerry Falwell Jr. about this, and he said, in essence, yep, this is what we're doing. We're driving the prominence of the actual residential college and its cultural implications with this online revenue.
Indeed, he's quite proud of their success and spoke about it quite freely. As he sees it, they've just become an American success story. And they're able to sustain the traditional college, the physical college. They've been able to do this by having found this very lucrative vein in American higher education, namely online classes. And he's quite proud of that.
And they are ambitious in their pursuit of that. There's a great little anecdote of, in fact, it is a call center, and Jerry Falwell Jr. calls it that, a call center that Liberty University Online set up like in the local mall after a Sears store went away. Explain how that works and why that's relevant.
Well, that's the heart of the business right there. They have this call center with hundreds of recruiters, and they are making calls nonstop from 8 in the morning till 8 at night under incredible pressure to get results. They're expected to sign up 8 people per day, 8 new students per day per recruiter. It really is kind of a boiler room type atmosphere that is the engine of this whole operation.
And they do it with amazing alacrity, right? I mean, it's the people searching online for, you know, Christian education, click on a link, and then Google sends it to the call center, and you know, a minute later, literally a minute later, that person's getting a call.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very finely tuned machine. Liberty spent last year $16.8 million on Google to get Google to promote it on searches for online higher education. It's an extraordinarily ambitious and really high-dollar operation.
A key thing here is the nonprofit status of Liberty University, right, and how that lets the school and then its online arm not be as scrutinized as for-profit colleges might be.
That really is the key distinction. The Obama administration clamped down quite a bit on for-profit colleges, which were getting more and more federal aid, taxpayer aid, to give to students, and many of whom were not getting very good educational results. But Liberty, by virtue of being a nonprofit, was exempt from a lot of those new restrictions. It not only was exempt from those restrictions, but it saw a lot of its competitors in this online realm really suffering under those restrictions while it was left pretty much unscathed.
The actual physical campus has become a center of and a highlight of Republican political campaigns. Candidates go there. They make speeches. The first commencement address President Trump gave after he came into office was at Liberty University. Just to be clear, it's the online part of this school that is driving that physical embodiment of what Jerry Falwell Jr. now runs.
Exactly. It is this very, very visible embodiment of this, of the power of the religious right. But in fact, what my reporting found was that it's all really being funded by these, by this completely different realm. These students out around the country, many of them quite desperate to sort of better their economic prospects, who are paying for these online courses, courses that are really often quite thin in what they're delivering. The reason why Liberty is so successful, why it's netting so much profit on these courses, is that they're spending incredibly little on the actual instruction for them.
Alec McGillis, who's a reporter at ProPublica, the piece about Liberty University, the headline is Billion Dollar Blessings, was published with the New York Times Magazine. Alec, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
It's a long way from Hollywood to the north of England, but a movie producer can dream, right? The producer in question is named Hopwood Dupree, and pay attention to that name because it's going to be important. Dupree set about researching his family tree not too long ago and discovered that for more than 500 years, his family had owned an ancestral home in the north of England, an old pile apparently that had gone derelict and is in danger of collapse, so he decided to save it. Marketplace's Stephen Beard met Dupree and took a tour.
A tour of Hopwood Hall starts unceremoniously at a steel fence that runs around the perimeter of the property.
This is our security gate. Keeps the vandals out.
Vandals, in fact, had run riot throughout the building long before Hopwood Dupree first clapped eyes on it, a crumbling, rubble-strewn but still magnificent wreck.
When I walked into the hall and saw all the beautiful ancient carvings and fireplaces, that's really what got me. And then they took me into a room and said, this is where your 14th great-grandfather was born. And that really made me stop and pause and think, wow, this has to be saved.
Tall, tanned and blonde, the youthful-looking movie producer doesn't look the part of conservationist, let alone Lord of the Manor. But leading our little tour through the rubble along the plank walkways, Hopwood points out the many features with proprietorial pride and enthusiasm.
This is a fireplace. It's called the Lord Byron fireplace, thought to be a gift from Lord Byron when he came to stay here.
Packed with fine architectural features, the house has nevertheless lain empty for years. Thieves ripped the lead off the roof, the rain came in, and, says local conservationist Bob Wall, whose long campaign to save the building, the rot set in.
We've had the lot, wet rot, dry rot, brown rot, cellar rot, call it what you want. We're doing quite well.
The house is still standing, but only just. Peter Barlow of Historic England, an official body charged with protecting the country's architectural heritage, was with us on the tour.
That ceiling's going to go soon, isn't it?
Yes, it's going to just collapse fairly imminently, really, and there's a lot of work to stabilise and soft prop some of the ceilings so we just don't lose them.
Nobody step on this bottom stair. We're going to go one at a time up the stairway, and we're going to stay to your right.
Hopwood leads us up a fragile staircase. His branch of the family last saw the house in the 18th century before emigrating to America. The hall's now owned by the local council. Galvanised by Hopwood, Historic England and the council have now put up $500,000 to stop the building falling down. Councillor Janet Emsley.
We're happy that somebody has taken an interest in one of our buildings and working towards it being restored.
Isn't it odd? It's apparently taken an American to get things going.
He may be an American, but he's got British roots.
The council's agreed to sell Hopwood his ancestral home for a negligible sum, so long as he comes up with a long-term plan for the hall and the money for a full restoration. That could be as much as $15 million. But with his movie maker's imagination, he sees revenue potential in every room.
This is the Georgian room. It has a big bay window, high ceilings where a grand chandelier once hung, was probably used as a ballroom for many events.
It's a terrific mess at the moment. Yeah. What's your vision for this?
I can almost feel and hear and see the parties, the laughter and the fun that probably happened in this room. So I envision bringing it back to that as an event space.
He believes that Hopwood Hall could thrive as a country house retreat for special occasions with its lake and babbling brook and bluebell wood, a great place to vacation, take a course, learn a new skill. That's the dream. Sounds like a movie in the making. At Hopwood Hall near Rochdale in the north of England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, news of a settlement in the case of a couple of weeks ago in Philadelphia, the two black men arrested for not leaving a Starbucks. The men have settled with the company for an undisclosed payment and an offer of a free college education. Here is the cool bit, though. A separate agreement with Philadelphia for a symbolic $1 each and a promise from the city to set up a $200,000 program for young entrepreneurs. I just thought that was cool. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials gave back 0.7% today, 174 points. NASDAQ down 0.4%, 29 points. S&P 500 gave back 0.7% as well, 19 points. Remember, the Fed said the economy's good, so, you know, stocks. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josted, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.